petition number 12385, Rule 2.
Mr. Williamson.
Yes.
Mr. Williamson, Rule 2. Right, Mr. Williamson, you were just describing how this dispute arose.
Yes. Look, I don't know whether this was the first dispute that I was in, but it's the one I remember. We'd be talking there, and they would say, "Well, in the morning when we go out for work there, that we'll ask to see the boss, and we'll say we want some extra money and so on." And also, it's a very good time to hold him. It's like holding him to ransom in a way, because the harvest is there and it's got to be gotten in and so on. So, but as I say, I can't remember the details exactly, but I think this first one came to some sort of compromise. We got some slight increase in the money is paid. I can't even remember how much that was, but very, very small. I think it amounted probably at the most to about a dollar a day or something when your food was taken into consideration. And then eventually either the job was finished, because a lot of these harvesting jobs, they're done by harvesting people that with the smaller farms anyway. They come and do the harvesting and then move on to the next, moving north all the time with the harvest. And then this continued for the best part of the summer. I ended up in southern Alberta there, with the winter coming on, and I got a job on a small ranch, I think. I don't know, only about 400 acres, 600 acres, and a few cattle. I got the job because I could ride and also working for small wages. I felt I was again exploited. I stopped there for, I can't remember now, a month or so, and then moved on west again. But by this time it was winter time, and very, very tough traveling on the trains in winter. But eventually I made it to Vancouver, and I don't know whether that was in the spring or the or the winter. It must have been early spring there. But I searched around and got jobs in different lumber camps, and again I met one or two IWW members, but they're mostly very old guys that have been in it at the end of the previous century. But most of the young guys, they weren't they didn't even know about it, because the organization had gradually fallen apart by that time.
What was the IWW stand for again? Can you remind me?
Industrial Workers of the World. And we were mostly known as Wobblies amongst ourselves, and they were great. Of course, earlier on there'd been the... of course, this wasn't so long after the great struggles in the of the iron ore mines in Western United States, when I can't recollect the name. Can you switch off just a famous, you're not recording the, oh, there was a famous, I'd heard about this, he was a Swede that had been doing many jobs, a sailor and every other job. I think my friend had told me about him back in Winnipeg, and how that the mine bosses in the United States, of course I recollect the names later on after this, but this he was eventually, and they had been gunning for him, the bosses in the United States, for many, many years, this Swede in there, and eventually they got their chance with a big mine strike in, I think it was in Nevada or something, but I'd have to read up to recollect it, but and then they gave him some phony trial. They brought him up and condemned him to death with a firing squad. Now, that remained in my memory. He was a wobbly, too. But, of course, this had happened, I think, about 1910 or something like that. But not so such a long time before. But anyway, in the lumber camps, I was generally the same sort of position. You'd working in a lumber camp, and then...
What sort of work were you doing in the lumber camp?
Oh, generally felling tree, all sorts of tree felling, and from Douglas fir to the to spruce and the other thing, and again you're on piecework when you're cutting the spruce for pulp, and you were working.
How did the piecework operate?
Well, you had so many cords. You had to cords of wood. You had to cut and stack and. And so on there, but and then they came around and assessed it. Again, I can't recollect what we were paid, but it was very poor. Again, the conditions varied from one lumber camp to another. These generally the lumber camps they were more permanent. Well, insofar as till they'd cleared one section of the land and then moved on, so that the bunk houses and so on were more permanent as compared to the bunk houses you'd had back on the prairie, and. So that you're working there, the food again varied from plentiful and bad to sometimes good and plentiful. You had to have plenty of food to keep out the cold and so on there. And I do. Recollect one time something that you never see now except in exhibitions. I think I've seen one or two in Australia and also in Canada, but they're just a pale imitation of the thing that that you have what you call a high climber, and that is at this time, they didn't have all the heavy trucks and so on for shifting the timber out of the country, out of the built-up lands. They didn't have the roadways, so you had mostly the what they did then. They selected the tallest and the straightest fir tree in the area, and then they'd have what they call a high climber, and he'd go up there, he'd climbing boots on, and a belt or a rope round his middle, and then he'd climb up this tree. As he climbed up, so he came to the branches that obstructed him. He would cut it with the axe and throw the branches down. So as he moved up to the top of the tree, that he's cutting all the branches, or most of the branches are right at the top of, on these Douglas firs, right at the top of the tree, so that you're climbing up this pole there. Then when you got within about 20 or 30 feet of the top, that you hang on there, you've got your belt round you and your climbing boots on, and then you'd unhitch the saw that, although there's only one of you, it's a two-man saw, and you'd start cutting the underside with the axe, and then start with the saw, and then the top would come off, fall to the ground, and then the guy would make his way down again, and then what they would do, someone else would take over then and climb up with a lot of tackle with, I've forgotten what you call the thing, the same as on ships, pulleys and so on, but he fastens that right to the top of the tree, and then when they've got that, he throws... he's also taken a rope up, which he passes over, and then they bring a big hawse up, and they use that as a mast for skidding the timber out of the built-up country, and especially if you're near a river, they'd skid it to the banks of the river. And I thought, well... you know, this is, of course, they were looked up to, and I was, although I was still very young, I thought, well, that's a sort of job for me, because you made as much for one climb as you'd earn in a whole month in the ordinary cutting and so on. So I don't know, I bothered and kept on going at different camps. So eventually I got a job doing that. But, of course, you've got to be, once you're at the top, and you could be 170 foot up, or most of the 200 feet up from the ground. At, and then once you've... cut this top part of the tree off, it springs just like the bow of just like the bow, like the string of a bow. It swings in a terrific arc, at least 30 feet each way. The tree swings there, and you've got to hang on like grim death until it stops swinging, just like a pendulum. And an upside-down pendulum, if you got the idea of the thing. And then you came down. And to a certain extent, you looked up, because not everyone had a head for heights and so on, so that especially when you were very young, you felt like a real kingpin then.
How old were you when you started doing that?
Oh, I suppose I was about 15 then, I suppose. But I said I was 18 or 19. Of course, I'd filled out considerable there with working hard all the time. And again, you'd often... I was... And you had to often change your name too, because if you got a name for being awkward and a union organizer and so on, they would, by this time, the IWW had given way to an international red union, I think, with a sort of international union. I've forgotten the actual name of it now, but the exact name, but I think it was a Comintern organization, but as opposed to the American Federation of Labor, which was also extended into Canada, you had this red union, which many belonged to the IF of L, the International Federation of Labor, the American Union, but that was a docile union, and I and others tried to get the people to join this sort of red union, not always with a great deal of extent. Sometimes you'd get the backing and you'd place your demands for the thing, but often you'd be fired.
Can you remember an example of that, when you got some people together and tried to fight again, that you're involved in that?
Not specific cases. They sort of merge into the thing. It happens because they weren't great union strikes. They would just be incidents that happen. Sometimes you'd get a slight increase in better conditions and a little bit more money. At other times, you'd fail and you'd be out on your neck, sort of thing.
Was it difficult to persuade the men to join the Red Union?
They were indifferent, mostly, the fact that they were there, that some took out union cards, and I think you paid only... I think it was about 10 cents a week or something like that, so it wasn't very much. Some of the other ones would say, what do you want to chase with that? That's some red organization or something. That this is just, you know, they would be all for the American Federation of Labor, so that, some did join, but it was very disjointed and so on. And again, you wandered from camp to camp, and also I made my way illegally across into the United States and down into Washington it went on for quite a while like that. In the meantime, one or two jobs on ranches in British Columbia as well for a short period of time. I can't recollect how long and exactly when. But it was after this that I crossed over into the States there, and I more or less traveled, hoboed my way, just getting jobs from time to time, and sometimes not getting a job at all, often going hungry and... but in spite of it, I enjoyed the thing, seeing all these sights. I remember I went to all the plates, Yosemite and the Grand Canyon, anywhere where a railroad went, then I went, and you'd get a job there. And then when you came off the train, you'd go round to the folks on in the town, and you'd knock on a door and say, "Lady, I'm real hungry. could I do some chores around the place there in return for a meal?" And that's what you kept on doing from time to time. I never at any time actually panhandled. I consider that degrading, that's begging, but I couldn't see anything wrong with begging for a food. And sometimes you'd get a real motherly type there, a real homey sort of elderly woman, and sort of graying hair. When you saw that, and they didn't shoo you off right away, you felt you're right in, you know, that you get your knees under the kitchen table and get a real meal. And then you regale them. And always I was very careful. Well, they say, "Where are you from, boy?" And so, and especially with these mother types, I wasn't increasing my age. I decreased my age because it would give them the chance to feel sympathetic towards you. And also, having read Jack London on his exploits, that but I was very careful to say, when they said, "Where are you from?" And I'd say always, "From New York City or New York, upstate New York or something," because, you know, you didn't want, if you were picked up, to be shoved over the border again. And then I went, more or less, I went down to Texas and so I tried to get a job on a ranch in Texas there. That and then I couldn't do that, so that I thought, well, I beat my way on a train crossing the border into Mexico, where I was there, I suppose, for about 3 months, and I got a job doing odd jobs, and also riding and looking after the cattle on a big hacienda. I think the boss was rather taken with having a gringo working for him, that if Nefe, and also I was working for very small wages, and then when I tried to get back across the border again, after that, I got on pretty well with this fellow. Of course, I had to be rather careful there. I was in a strange country. He probably knew I didn't have any papers or anything there. But he was friendly enough. He had a big family and so on. They invited me to the house once or twice, and he slept in the bunkhouse with some other, what do they call them? I've forgotten the name, what they call, anyway, that the equivalent of cow punchers in Mexico. I used to know the name. But anyway, that when I tried to get back across the border there, that was a different thing. There wasn't much of a search of the trains coming from the United States. But everyone was telling me how that going back the other way, there was search from beginning to end. The customs people, the immigration people would be searching every inch, and there's no way of that. So I beat my way down to a port in Mexico there, and I hung about the docks for a while there, and then I managed to ship on an American ship there that was going to California that had called in there. So I got a job on that. I can't remember the name of the ship now, but we went through the Panama Canal and up to the West Coast, where I was paid off again. Then somehow I made my way to, I think, Seattle. I had a feeling all the time I had, also with my love of locomotives, which was part of my reason for loving the hobo's life, these great American locomotives. When I came to England, first of all, I had a feeling that, you know, when they talk about these great locomotives in England, I see them on the thing. I thought how puny and small they were compared to our locomotives, and especially the Union Pacific ones, and so on. That I've lost the then.
Can I just ask you?
Pardon?
Mr. Williamson, can I just ask you, did you continue to read during this time when you
got a chance? Oh, yes, I forgot to mention that I read, and when I couldn't get the books legitimately, I sort of got paperback books and so on. I just stole them from the different libraries I went to, that I felt they're probably not by read anyway, by... Anyway, libraries have plenty of money and they're replaced. And I had these books. Of course, I couldn't take a whole library around with me, but I'd read them. But I would never leave it. One thing I had was this abiding love for books, that you, not only do you read them, but you mustn't destroy them or deface them or dog-ear them or something there. So if I stole a book from Portland, Oregon, for instance, I might return it to some library in some different state, hundreds of miles away. I always continue to read and. And before I'd left, I was already reading. My friend gave me books by Marx and so on, which was beyond me at the time. But I did find Engels rather easier to read than Marx. I think I read his Ante Deering, as I say, when you get older, your memory goes, most of the books of Marx. At a later time, I even read Das Kapital right through at. I don't know how long. I used to read very, very rapidly, and I read it right through and then went back and read part of it. And I still didn't understand it, but I read it anyway. But I understand the gist of the thing. But, of course, way easier was the Communist Manifesto, which I read and always carried with me. At all times I had the Communist Manifesto.
This is when you were travelling around as a hobo. You always carried the Communist Manifesto.
Yes. I'd always have the Communist Manifesto. And it would be worn out, and I'd get another copy from one of the left-wing bookshops when you got to San Francisco or where I have... wherever. I think from Seattle, after traveling, I came back to Portland, Oregon. There was a six-masted schooner, the Helen B. Sterling.
Before you tell me this, Mr. Williamson, could I just ask you, what other books did you read during this stage which you remember particularly?
What books?
What other books did you read during that time which you remember made an impression on you? Can you remember? Just briefly.
Yes. As I say, my memory, as I've gotten old, I read every sort of thing. I read Barbusse, Under Fire. I remember that great French writer. I read many of the great French writers. In my earlier days, of course, when I consider as just in my childhood days, I was sort of... also, I was given books of adventure like Dumas' books of the Three Musketeers and that sort of thing. But I soon grew out of that because my friend said they're all fighting for the king and authority. So that, another great book that. Two great books, that is by the great French writer. Can you... the one that had a great effect on me is Zola's Germinal. That had a great... and also...